To what extent has aggressive policing been historically supported by African Americans? Khalil Gibran Muhammad will join us to talk about his review of Michael Fortner's Black Silent Majority, the Rockefeller Drug Laws and the Politics of Punishment.
There's no question about the significance of the relationship of crime and drugs to concerns about public safety and anxiety within Harlem and elsewhere.
Is there a right-wing plot to derail Hillary Clinton? David Brock, author of Killing the Messenger, thinks there is, and our reviewer, Hannah Rosen, joins us to discuss.
There's something about the Clintons that's just like inherently distasteful and brings out the worst in reporters. That's not a bad conversation to have.
Alexander Alter will fill us in with the latest from the literary world. Greg Coles has bestseller news. And we'll let readers and listeners ask a few questions or answer a few questions for us editors here at the Book Review. This is Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Pamela Paul. Khalil Gibran Muhammad, who is the director of New York City's Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture and the author of The Condemnation of Blackness, Race, Crime, and the Making of Modern Urban America, joins us now. Hi, Khalil.
Hi, Pam. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. So this week in the Book Review, you review Black Silent Majority, The Rockefeller Drug Laws and the Politics of Punishment by Michael Fortner. This book is already making a lot of waves. Tell us what it's about.
It is about a moment in New York's history when a coalition of African Americans, from business owners to ministers to community activists, came together around a crisis of heroin addiction and crime as a result. And for them, the need to do something about criminal victimization in Harlem set in motion a series of political changes that culminated in the Rockefeller Drug Laws of 1973.
And who is the author? Who is Fortner?
Fortner is an assistant professor at CUNY's School of Professional Studies and a political scientist.
All right. And what is his argument in the book? Because that, I think, is the cause of much of the controversy and discussion.
His argument is that the shift from civil rights activism in the 50s and 60s went somewhere, that the culmination of the Civil Rights Acts of 64 and 65 did not disappear. That political mobilization ultimately landed in very localized spaces where the promises of civil rights were not as readily apparent or burning issues on the minds of many people. What they were concerned about was the onset of a drug and crime problem. That's essentially Fortner's argument.
And what years are we talking about?
We're talking about, he situates the moment between the 50s when there's a kind of heyday of optimism and economic change to a downturn beginning in the early 60s, particularly around 1962, when there begins to be organizing and concern about a new face of drug addiction that seems more pernicious and dangerous than before.
How Harlem-centric is his research? Because the Rockefeller drug laws, of course, expanded to 48 states. How
the book is a New York story. Mm-hmm. It is the relationship between Harlem as the epicenter of a new crisis of drug addiction, and that Harlem as the cultural capital of Black America. And so for him, zeroing in on that local community becomes the best way to unpack the genealogy of a larger war on drugs that unfolds after the Rockefeller drug laws.
Now, as director of the Schomburg Center, you are at the center of that cultural center now. How true does his argument ring? I mean, you have criticisms in your review.
Sure. There's no question, both as evidenced by our archives, as evidenced by the well-known articulations of people like Malcolm X, who were very clear in public speeches about gangs and drugs and alcohol. Much of the leadership of the Nation of Islam itself was predicated on lost souls in prisons by virtue of these various kinds of things. People like Kenneth Clark, who had a neighborhood organization, a social service organization in Harlem, was very concerned about drug addiction and crime in the community. So there's no question about the significance of the relationship of crime and drugs to concerns about public safety and anxiety within Harlem and elsewhere.
Okay, let's go to the title of the book. Where does this term Black Silent Majority come from?
According to Fortner, the term is related to a memo that Daniel Patrick Moynihan, former Assistant Secretary of Labor under Johnson and later an advisor to President Nixon, wrote in 1970, calling attention to what Moynihan simply describes as perhaps America's greatest challenge, which is the behavior of young black men in the nation's inner cities. And he coins the term black silent majority, sets off a bit of controversy in the moment with black political scientist Charles Hamilton writing in response. Again, it's a very tricky line that even Hamilton acknowledges and walks along, which is, yes, black people are afraid of criminals in their own community, but no, they've not renounced the relationship of that criminality to a larger structure of inequality.
And who were these people? They were working class, middle class, according to Moynihan?
According to Moynihan, they were the moderates, the politically moderates, those in the center of American politics. They just happened to be black in this way. They were people who essentially worked hard and even had something to lose in the sense of safety and community as either property owners, as business owners, or people aspiring to property ownership.
And he was urging Nixon to focus on this group as a potential backers of him politically.
That's right. The context of it was to push back against the significance of the black left by and large. And that black left represented largely by the Black Panther Party and other organizations that took the failures of the civil rights movement to reconcile with economic inequality and the maldistribution of political power. This is really at the moment and just before African Americans become mayors of cities and sort of become a significant part of even the Nixon administration. So that push for more aggressive social distribution of resources is expressed on a left, which is now under attack by the federal government through counterintelligence programs. And Nixon is being advised by Moynihan to really focus on the center because you're going to lose your capacity to control these competing interests within the black community.
All right, let's talk about the problems that you see in Fortner's argument. He's basically saying that the Rockefeller drug laws, this wasn't just sort of, you know, angry white people coming up with these draconian laws, but that there was a strong backing in the African-American community, particularly in Harlem. What do you see that's wrong with that argument?
Sure. I think he's right that there were constituents for a push for more punitive laws.
Mm-hmm.
He's wrong in letting white suburbanites, his term by and large, off the hook in the way that he does. He seems to only want to impute racial complicity in the punitive aspirations of African Americans in explicit language.
Mm-hmm.
And because he can't find explicit language in the evidence that he uses, largely survey results and polling data, he therefore overstates the voice of African Americans calling for this, minimizes the stakes and the payoff or the sort of accumulated understandings of black people and criminality as synonymous.
Right.
None of that really complicates his story.
You also point out that there's not a lot of context here. The choices that African Americans had at the time were very limited, that it was sort of a choice between fewer cops, fewer prisons, or more cops, more prisons, and that there weren't other viable solutions out there to address.
That's right. So one of the things that's striking in his argument is he doesn't address the messiness of the counter positions of what people he would call white liberals or the black civil rights community, only to say that his black silent majority are not listening to them. So something like the Kerner Commission report, which comes out of a number of urban rebellions and uprisings that occur between 65 and 67, launched a significant appraisal of the structural conditions under which most of African Americans labored. That some within those structural conditions were less concerned about those structural conditions doesn't change that in the policymaking circles, these were very real concerns. And so the Kerner Commission is clear about the nature of discontent and the collateral damage of that discontent, including self-destructive antisocial behavior, such as drug use. Fortner doesn't wrestle with those arguments. He dismisses them because he has enough evidence of people who were not concerned with those as he interprets. I find that to minimize the complexity of the context, and because there were political actors in the Nixon administration and elsewhere, Barry Goldwater and those he inspired, such as Ronald Reagan and others, are rejecting the Kerner Commission report.
Mm-hmm.
And that politic is definitely part of Nelson Rockefeller's calculation, as it would have been anyone with national aspirations in a governorship of New York or elsewhere.
The book is published by Harvard University Press, and Fortner is an academic. So it's not like it was sort of rushed out to meet the headlines, but it does land at an interesting moment in terms of what's going on. How has this been received?
It has been received. We've mostly heard, and by we meaning readers, as a critic, I have also read other pieces with some trepidation as to how it matches up or aligns with a bipartisan movement for criminal justice reform. One could argue, and one suspects, that the conceptualization of this work was could not anticipate mm-hmm. the speed with which so many people, for different reasons, are interested in rolling back mass incarceration. And I do think that for Fortner, he wanted to lift up the voices of those who continue to be less invested in structural critiques and racism and more invested in what does it mean to send one's child to school every day, whether it's in Chicago or Baltimore or Philadelphia. I think at the end of the day, that's what he was invested in. He names it in his own biographical story within the book, and he's to be applauded for lifting up that voice. But he takes that nugget and pushes it too far.
All right. Book again is Black Silent Majority, The Rockefeller Drug Laws and the Politics of Punishment by Michael Fortner. And we're talking to Khalil Gibran Muhammad, director of the Schomburg Center, who reviews it this week in the book review. Khalil, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Alexandra Alter joins us now with Notes from the Publishing World. Hi, Alexandra.
Hi, Pamela.
So you've got a few things going on this week.
Yes, it's a big week for publishing news. There was a major acquisition at Gallery Books, which is a Simon & Schuster imprint. They acquired Amy Schumer's memoir. Everyone was sort of talking about the fact that she was working on a book and shopping the proposal around. There were a lot of rumors flying around. And so Gallery sent out the announcement today that they had acquired it. They've been getting into a lot of sort of celebrity and lifestyle books. So.
I feel like it's so inevitable that Amy Schumer would write a book that I almost feel like she has already written it.
I feel the same way, and I'm still going to read it when it comes out. I'm excited. But according to Entertainment Weekly, they paid quite a bit for it. It was a heated auction. And
well, celebrities need money.
They do. I mean, they can barely get by. So she apparently got a high seven-figure deal, they're saying, between $8 and $10 million, Entertainment Weekly, which is high even by celebrity standards. I think the Tina Fey got somewhere between $5 and $6 million for her book, Bossy Pants, which went on to be a huge bestseller. And Lena Dunham got around $3.7 million reportedly for her book. That seemed to be what most people were getting. But, you know, she's having a real moment. She won her Emmy. She was in a big movie, Trainwreck. So, you know, a book is obviously the next step.
And Mindy Kaling's new book just came out. That's doing pretty well, right?
Yes, it is. And Jesse Eisenberg, another actor's book, just came out. Mary Louise Parker's book just came out, and Ethan Hawke's book is coming out. So we're sort of inundated
right
now.
You're on top of it all. Never mind the high-minded literary folks of the season.
I'm busy with these actors.
All right. Let's do a big change in topic here and talk about what's going on in the ebook world. Big news also with Oyster.
That's right. Oyster announced this week that they'll be winding down their service. This is an ebook subscription service, which in the past couple of years has started to seem like the hot new thing. You know, it's the Netflix of books. It's a new way for the
oldest. Startup?
It was a startup. They had about $17 million in investment. And the idea is basically to, for a flat monthly fee, offer readers unlimited ebook reading, similar to Netflix or Spotify. The model never really took off. I think, you know, first they had trouble getting publishers to sign on and put their big new books on these services. And of course, that's what's really going to get people onto those services.
Right. It's also a lot easier and faster to like speed consume unlimited amounts of television than it is books. Isn't
I mean,
it?
I could see, you know, binge watching Game of Thrones, but getting through all of George R. R. Martin's The Song of Ice and Fire would be a lot tougher. So people are looking at this as, you know, a big question mark on these types of services. On the other hand, apparently most of their employees went to Google Books Play. So some people are speculating that it means Google is going to get into into this space and perhaps develop some kind of subscription service for their Android phone or their Android devices, which would put it in a lot more hands and maybe make it an easier prospect for people. But of course, I think the key is getting publishers to sign on and getting the kind of content that people want to read. And one other subscription service, Scribd, actually took all their romance titles off because the more people read, the more they have to pay publishers, mm-hmm. and they couldn't support the cost of feeding insatiable romance readers.
Wow.
So that just shows sort
of
the limits of the model.
So some people can read a lot.
Apparently, binge reading is a thing. And this kind of fits into a bigger trend that we've been seeing in the publishing industry where ebook sales just aren't really holding up the way they have in the past few years.
I'm going to use a very print term, your A1 story this week on the subject, which switching over to E was, I think, number two most emailed, was about the sort of surprising softness of the ebook category.
It is surprising. I mean, there were these predictions 5 years ago that by now, you know, more than half of book sales would be digital. And instead, you know, ebook sales have really leveled off. They only grew by 4% last year. And in the first 5 months of this year, they were actually down 10%, which was a big surprise to people. And, you know, in the meantime, some print categories have been growing, paperback especially, and bookstores are really seeing this as an advantage, particularly independents have been growing. More of them are opening up, more of them are staying open, and their sales are up. So it's certainly benefiting them. I mean, there's a question of, you know, price and things like that. Some publishers have raised the prices on their ebooks since they renegotiated terms with Amazon. So that might be guiding people away from ebooks. And then the devices that really got a lot of people into reading digitally, like the Kindle, the Nook, are not as popular apparently as they used to be. Now that people have smartphones and tablets, do you really need a third device? So people might be reading on their smartphones and tablets, but they don't read as much on those things because there's other stuff to do.
Well, I'm not going to say I told you so. Thanks so much, Alexandra.
Thanks for having me.
Hannah Rosen joins us from Washington. She is the author most recently of The End of Men and the Rise of Women. And this week, she reviews a new book by David Brock, Killing the Messenger, The Right-Wing Plot to Derail Hillary and Hijack Your Government. Hi, Hannah.
Hi.
Thanks for being here.
I'm delighted.
This book is by David Brock, who's very familiar to people who watch lots of talk TV, but maybe not to everyone. So tell us a little bit about who Brock is.
David Brock is such an interesting character in American politics. As a young reporter, he worked for the American Spectator, which was a very beloved conservative paper, which was going through an identity change when he got there and basically becoming investigative. It was like an intellectual magazine became investigative. And he was their star reporter and essentially, like, investigated the hell out of the Clintons. And Anita Hill. He wrote the famous Anita Hill story, too. He just became the dogged investigative reporter of the left. And then
reporting on the left for the right, we should say.
Yes, he was very much of the right, and he reporting on the left and primarily on, or famously on, Anita Hill and then the Clintons. And that became kind of a crusade. And then he had a moment where, a change of heart moment.
Well, before he got to that moment, let's just talk about his reporting on Clinton's, because it was really instrumental in terms of what then followed with Bill Clinton and all the investigations into Whitewater, et cetera.
If you look back at it now, it was in the 90s, and it really set the tone for, I think, all these right-wing bestsellers that we still read and that still dog the Clintons. It's not that there was no truth in some of the stuff, like his first famous story, Troopergate, which was the troopers who were guarding then-Governor Clinton, talking about all his mistresses and the things they had to do to kind of keep his extramarital dalliances quiet and delivering gifts and all the stuff. Like, the LA Times ran a version of that story. They were head-to-head on that story. It's not that there was nothing to them or nobody else followed up on them, but he would include sentences here and there that was just, like, very loose. Like, clearly not fact-checked. It was not a fact-checking kind of magazine. So you couldn't really tell the difference between what was real and what was surreal. And I think that's what was distinctive and became the tone for all these right-wing bestsellers over the years. They kind of mixed things that were investigatable and fact-checkable with things that were completely insane.
Then he has a major turn of heart, to put it mildly.
Yes. He has a major turn of heart. First, he writes an Esquire story basically saying, I was duped. I was part of this right-wing propaganda machine. I realized that all these people were just out to get the Clintons. They weren't real journalists. They weren't interested in the truth. Also, I'm gay, and they didn't accept my gayness. And so, it all his identity turn all got mixed in with his political transformation. In the then what happened, I actually didn't know until reading this latest book. Like, I'd always wondered. So, like, just because he had a transformation, do you just, like, call up the Clintons and be like, I'm your friend now, so let's be buddies because I don't hate you anymore. Like,
right.
How does that actually work?
But he wrote a book before. I mean, he did write a memoir, Blinded by the Right. Did he talk about that transition in his first book?
Yeah, his book was an extended version of the Esquire piece he wrote. So, yes, he talked extensively and in some cases a little nastily about some of his old friends. He went into great detail about the reporting, but again, he didn't do a thing where he like distinguished between the things that were true in his Troopergate story and the things that the LA Times also wrote about and the things that were completely bogus. He just said this was a conspiracy, it was funded by people who were out to get the Clintons, they didn't care about the truth, and they just wanted to, you know, bring the Clintons down. And so everything I wrote was a lie fed to me by these people who were out to get them.
All right. So you said that now in this book, Killing the Messenger, you found out sort of how it all went down. How did he make up with them?
Yeah. And then I should say he also got a commission to write a book about Hillary Clinton, which was supposed to be a hit job, but was kind of a measured assessment, somewhat admiring of Hillary Clinton. And that was the last nail in the coffin between him and his right-wing allies. Like, once he published that book, and it wasn't what his publisher wanted, and it wasn't what anyone expected, and it wasn't red meat-ish, then he was out for good. So I guess he'd already tipped his hand. He'd already showed the Clintons that, like, he had admiration for them for various reasons. But what I learned from this book, again, it's like, you know, imagine any human, imagine yourself in that situation. Like, someone's been publicly hating on you, essentially ruining your life, like publishing rumors about not just Bill's affairs, but Hillary and Vince Foster, like just the worst things you would ever want the world to know about you. And then that person says, I'm sorry. It's not like you then befriend them. Well, in his version, at least, the Clintons immediately embraced him. Like, Bill Clinton read his book and called him up and was like, here's my speaking agent, and you should immediately get out there and start talking about this, and why don't we start an organization together to counter the right-wing lies? And, you know, it was like they fast and hard embraced him, which I think is unusual.
Now, Brock did go on to found an organization, Media Matters. Was it co-founded with Bill Clinton?
Essentially. I mean, that's what we learned, is that, like, it was not, like, co-founded. It seemed like it was Bill Clinton's idea from David Brock's book. Like, mm-hmm. That David Brock was sort of sitting there lonely, having published his book, not sure what to do with his life, what his next step was. And then the way he tells the story, it's like Bill Clinton had the idea, Hillary Clinton provided the money. I mean, there were probably lots of other sources, but Bill was the one who planted the seed that was like, do this, make a big organization, turn this into your life's work. Like, we need an organization to counter the lies and propaganda of the right, and you are the man to do that. And suddenly he had a new mission in life, and then Hillary introduced him to all her fundraising friends, and that's what got him started. Like, because, you know, how do you get the trust of people who are Democrats, like, once you are solidly, like, you don't even know those people. They weren't in your world. So it seems like the Clintons actually made the introductions and made the whole thing possible.
I want to get back to the issue of trust in a second, but I first have to say one of the most interesting facts that I found from your review was that Bill Clinton delivered a eulogy for Richard Mellon Scaife, who was, you know, if anything, maybe one of the prime funders of what Hillary called the vast right-wing conspiracy. So it's almost like Brock and Clinton, in a way, seem birds of a feather in this respect, in this way to sort of befriend their former enemies.
Yeah, isn't that amazing? I mean, it was amazing to me when I learned, I'd learned this through reporting separate from the book. This wasn't a sentence that was in the book, but how systematically, essentially, those reconciliations happened. Like, whenever anyone from that, from what Hillary called the right-wing conspiracy, offered a hand, the Clintons would take it immediately. Now, I don't know what that speaks to. Like, does that speak to an openness of heart? or does that speak to, like, we just want to gather as many allies as possible, or Bill's insatiable need to be liked? I have no idea. And obviously, I don't know what was like deep in Hillary's soul. But yes, it happened systematically. Like, the SCAFE meeting was arranged by another, like, right-wing publishing magnate who had this idea and sort of brought them together at lunch. And they had this six-hour lunch together in which they talked to each other and became friends. And then it became obvious somehow that Bill had to give a eulogy at the funeral. And it seemed like Bill just, like, from what we know about him, he would go to any lengths to win someone over. Like, he really didn't like this situation where someone was his enemy, and he would just, like, you know, seduce, and was often successful. Like, the right-wing people I spoke to, even ones who are still running right-wing magazines, like, one of them told me he was going to vote for Hillary. She's a wonderful lady. It's like, he had some magic power to win people over. Or I should say, they have some magic power. Maybe it's star power. Maybe it's charm. I don't know what it is, but they really would win people over.
What about David Brock? Is he a persuasive writer? Do you feel like you trust him telling the story that he does in this book?
Understanding him as a narrator was quite difficult, because when I went into it, I thought of him as a shifting ideologue, like someone who just, you know, we've known people over the years, it's like they're a Marxist. This is like the story of the neocons, like,
right,
people who attach themselves so strongly to an ideology, and then that ideology shifts, but the central thing about them is that they buy in whole heart, like they're all in, you know,
mm-hmm.
And then they're just by nature very ideological. Now, he does not present himself like that in the book. He says, I'm more of a practical person, which makes him seem mercenary, more like a political operative or a political tool or something. So it was kind of difficult to get a handle on him. And there were so many passages in the book which felt so press releasey to me, like felt like he wasn't willing to make distinctions between, you know, the things about Hillary that were great and the things about Hillary that were media. And the things about Hillary that we shouldn't admire. Like, he wasn't operating in that book like a journalist or an anthropologist. He was operating like a press person. And so even though, you know, he's at the center of a certain kind of history, and I personally think this history is really interesting and important, like how the right-wing propaganda machine got built and what it is and how important it is and what role it plays in modern politics, all really important, really interesting. And David Brock is definitely the right person to tell that story. But then the story about Hillary Clinton, like, after a while, you just start not to trust him. Like, the language is so so the language of, you know, a kind of paid supporter.
What evidence does he present in the book to support the subtitle, which is The Right-Wing Plot to Derail Hillary and Hijack Your Government?
I didn't understand, even after reading it, about the title before we get to the subtitle. Like, I still don't really know who the messenger is. Who's the messenger?
It might be the New York Times, apparently.
Oh, my God. I totally missed that.
Well, since we're on that, let's talk about the New York Times, this paper, because he has a lot of criticism for our coverage here of Hillary Clinton. What does he say that the New York Times has done?
Okay. In that case, like, the title and the subtitle just don't match. Like, nobody understands that intuitively, that the right-wing plot to derail Hillary and hijack your government, like, includes the New York Times.
It might not. It could be, you know, there is a picture on the cover of an elephant on top of the White House, so maybe it's that elephant is the messenger.
I don't really know. I mean, because then you really got, I mean, that's where he was losing me, where it seemed to me like merely by criticizing Hillary Clinton, you became the enemy.
Right.
Like, just you say that it doesn't matter who you are or if you're identified as right. You are inherently, just by saying the words out of your mouth, an enemy. So, you know, he has some legitimate criticisms of the New York Times, but they're just like, he does not make distinction in the tone, quality of his criticisms of the New York Times that he does of, like, what the American Spectator did. You know, to him, it's all ideologically driven, and that doesn't, like, inherently make sense. Like,
right.
It doesn't inherently, and he tries to do it by talking about, like, oh, this reporter has ties to the right wing, but I think that's a really hard case to make, that the New York Times, when it comes to the Clintons, is driven by a right-wing agenda. You know, it's just, that's a really, really hard case to make.
What does he say exactly that the Times has done?
So basically what he does is, like, he analyzes the various personalities who were involved in writing about different Clinton scandals. So he begins with Jeff Gerth and the Whitewater scandal, and then he goes to William Safire, Howell Raines, a liberal Southerner who hated the Clintons for his own personal reasons. Like, he does basically an anthropology of Clinton haters at the New York Times. Maureen Dowd is another Clinton hater at the New York Times because she wrote a series of columns criticizing Hillary Clinton, and he counts the columns, and he's not the only one to say this. But again, this is nothing to do with the right-wing plot to derail Hillary. Like, you could actually probably write an interesting chapter that was like, what is the basis of the media's distaste? Like, are we sensing something in the nature of both the reporting and the critical column writing, which goes beyond just your, you know, like, average criticism? Is there something about the Clintons that's just, like, inherently distasteful and brings out the worst in reporters? That's not a bad conversation to have. I mean, you could have that discussion, but that is not the same as the right-wing plot to hijack your government and destroy Hillary Clinton. Those are, like, two completely separate conversations. Like, one is about journalism and sort of people's, you know, sort of personal temperament and taste, and that how that brings to bear to the stories that they choose and the columns that they write. And another is about a, like, systematic and true effort that conservatives have made and built an empire of, which did not exist when David Brock was a young reporter, but an empire of media outlets, and, you know, which are all kind of completely legal and above board, much more so than when he was doing it. But, you know, just like a right-wing conglomerate, as I call it, that's made up of public interest groups and grassroots activists and media outlets, and this, like, it really built an empire of criticism that is quite effective, and that is not the same as the New York Times.
One last question, just a parallel between the first book that he wrote, Blinded by the Right, and this most recent book, Killing the Messenger. Blinded by the Right, a lot of people said, okay, no matter what you think of Brock, whether you trust him or not, whether you think he's now, you know, a sincere liberal, said, here's a fascinating look at sort of the behind-the-scenes right-wing stuff that was going on in the 90s. In Killing the Messenger, do you think, did he do any of that for this most recent electoral period? Does he shed a light in terms of what's going on?
Yeah, you have to work hard to find it. I mean, the problem is he's not an insider. Like, there is something genuinely exhilarating about somebody who is a traitor in that way, like, who does have a first row seat and an information and a set of contacts that most people don't have, and then he turns on all these people. He does have a body of knowledge that we don't have. He's been out of touch with the right wing for many, many years, so the only pose he can take is as an anthropologist. Like, he has a little bit of distance. They haven't trusted him in, you know, 15
right.
years or
he's
so.
He's gone from the guard dog to the watchdog.
Yeah, he's the watchdog, so he doesn't have it. He's the last person that anybody in the right would tell all their secrets to at this point. So, but what he does have is he has, you know, a base of knowledge of how the right operates from 15 years ago, and he has a front row seat from kind of these media watchdog organizations that he builds. So, like, if he had approached this book as an anthropologist, I think a ton of interesting stuff could have come out of it.
Well, maybe he'll do that in the next book. Hannah, great to talk to you.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Hannah is the author most recently of The End of Men and the Rise of Women, and this week she reviews David Brock's new book, Killing the Messenger. John Williams is here now, representing the voice of the people, or our listeners and people who follow us on Twitter and Facebook and the like. Hi, John.
Hey, Pamela.
So this week you wrote your open book column about books on female friendship, which was, I think, in response to Anne Friedman's review of Marilyn Yalom's new book, The Social Sex, A History of Female Friendship. What did you do in your column? You asked people something.
Well, I asked some people at the Times for favorite novels that had the theme of female friendship, because I thought it would just be a nice companion to the review in last week's issue of The Social Sex, A History of Female Friendship. And so we got a few answers. Jennifer Salai, our colleague at the Book Review, named Zadie Smith's NW, about a group of four friends who grew up together in London. The food columnist Melissa Clark named Henry James's Portrait of a Lady. Alexandra Jacobs, who works on our styles desk, named Maud Hart Lovelace's Betsy Tacy series for younger readers, which I'm sure you're very familiar with. I didn't read those as a kid.
You didn't read those as a kid?
No.
That's so strange. And what about our listeners, our readers, our tweeters? What
When we put this up on Facebook, several people responded with their own. Two people, Lynn M. Colia and Rosemary Berry Britton, both named Sunflower and the Secret Fan by Lisa C., which is a novel about two Chinese women in 19th century, a remote county in 19th century China, who become friends at six or seven in kind of an arranged friendship, almost like an arranged marriage. And they send notes back and forth to each other throughout their lives about what they've experienced. Rosie Van Strop said Braided Lives by Marge Piercy is the best book about friendship she's read. Libby Cokemore said Without a Doubt, The Robber Bride by Margaret Atwood. Lucia Janisova named Elena Ferrante's My Brilliant Friend, which is the first volume in her recently concluded quartet of Neapolitan novels. And I have to admit that when I approached people at the Times for their choices, I asked them if they could to avoid naming Ferrante because
otherwise everyone would.
It's very much in everyone's minds these days, and I wanted to preempt the possibility that we'd have five or six people all naming those books. And then a couple of people, you know, rightly noted that they asked why I didn't ask men the same question because all four people at the Times I asked were women.
We'll all do it then, John. What's your favorite book on female friendship?
I'll represent men. The one that came to mind was Laurie Moore's Who Will Run the Frog Hospital, which I read a long time ago, but it has all of her humor and insight. And it's about a woman who's in her early 40s, I believe, who sort of looks back on a teenage friendship with someone who she worked at a theme park with. And it's very short, and I would highly recommend it to people.
Next time we throw a question out there, how can people find out what the question is and answer it?
Well, they can follow us on Twitter at NYTimesBooks and on Facebook now at facebook.com/NYTBooks. And they can always write to us also at our dedicated email address, which is books@nytimes.com. So we'll throw something else out again this week that people can respond to.
Brought to you by the New York Times. All right. Thanks, John.
Thanks, Pamela.
And now we've got Greg Coles with Bestseller News. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Pamela.
What's new on the list?
Well, pull up a seat and pour yourself a drink, because with six new titles in fiction and another six in nonfiction, there's a lot of action this week. In fiction, the first new title is down at number 14. William R. Fortune has a new book called 1 Year After. It's kind of a survivalist dystopia about the destruction of the U.S. power grid by a nuclear attack. It's a sequel to his 2009 bestseller, 1 Second After. So it's taken him 6 years to write about 1 year. Then at number 13, Richard Castle has book 7 of his Nikki Heat series. That's called Driving Heat. New at number 10, Janet Ivanovich is back on the list with The Scam. That's part of a series that she's writing with Lee Goldberg. It's the Fox and O'Hare series, book 4 in that. It's kind of following the James Patterson model where you have an established kind of brand name author pairing with somebody else to write a series.
They get tired.
They do get tired. Then at number 9, again, an established author with a frequent co-author, Catherine Coulter and J.T. Ellison have paired up for book 3 of their Nicholas Drummond Brit in the FBI series. This one's called The End Game. New at number 7, our cover girl, Lauren Groff, is on the list with her new novel, Fates and Furies.
I was about to say, where's the literary fiction? There it is.
there it is, new at number 7. And finally, up at number 3, J.D. Robb, who her regular readers will know is really Nora Roberts, is back on the list with Devoted in Death. That is part of her Lieutenant Eve Dallas series of futuristic suspense novels. It's the 20th year that it's the 20th year that Nora Roberts has been writing as J.D. Robb.
What's going on with nonfiction?
Also, six new titles, as I mentioned. Starting down at number 16, this is one that we talked about last week, Jewel is on the list with her memoir, Never Broken. So continuing the trend of female singers and rockers.
She writes children's books, too.
I did not know that. Then at number 15, Stephen Breyer, also a book that we talked about a couple of weeks ago.
Also a cover boy.
Yeah. The Court and the World. It's his look at kind of the politics of the Supreme Court, and especially international law, and whether the Supreme Court should consider international law in its rulings. Then jumping all the way up to number 5, David Brock is on the list with Killing the Messenger.
Which we talked about earlier on the podcast.
Yeah, this is the Hillary Clinton defense and media attack. Then at number...
That was very diplomatic. You didn't say New York Times attack. All right.
We've covered that on the podcast. Then at number four, a book called Fast Girl by the three-time Olympian, the runner Susie Favor Hamilton, written with Sarah Tomlinson. Hamilton went to the Olympics in 1992 and 1996 and again in 2000. She never won a medal, but this book is not so much about her time in the Olympics. It's about her diagnosis with bipolar disorder and how until she was properly diagnosed and treated, she lived a double life as a call girl in Las Vegas. Then at number three, Mary Carr, the best-selling memoirist, has a book about memoir. It's called The Art of Memoir. It's kind of part an instructional manual and part an analysis of other people's memoirs. She looks at Nabokov and Maxine Hung Kingston and some other memoirists there to kind of look at how they do what they do.
So it's only fitting that at number one we have a
memoir, really a collection of personal essays, the second collection of personal essays by the actress Mindy Kaling. It's a book called Why Not Me. Partly it is memoiristic, partly also there's some self-help type stuff in there, encouragement to women. She wrote quite a well-received essay addressing a fan who'd asked her, how are you so confident? And she kind of backed up and said that she didn't give a very good answer to that young woman. And so she wanted to explain now really how women can get confidence. And it was work hard, know your stuff, earn your stuff, and then you can feel entitled.
So the title should be pronounced, Why Not Me? That's what you're saying.
That is what I'm saying.
All right. Thanks, Greg.
Thanks, Pamela.
Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. Our producer is Jocelyn Gonzalez, and you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. Thanks for listening. For the New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.